Support for this podcast comes from American Express. No matter what you do in business, from building a better mousetrap to building a better app, it's easier when you don't go it alone. The powerful backing of American Express, don't do business without it. Hey, it's Guy here, and today we've got a brand new live episode of How I Built This featuring Emily Weiss of Glossier. But before we start the show, a lot of people ask, you know, how can we support How I Built This? And the best way to support what we do is by supporting your local public radio station. Here at NPR, we're launching our annual fundraising campaign starting Tuesday, November 27th, which is Giving Tuesday. But if you're listening to the show on Wednesday or Thursday or Friday, it doesn't matter. It's never too late to pitch in. It's really easy. Just go to donate.npr.org/built. That's donate.npr.org/built. And thanks.
So we flew to LA, we got our like Hertz rental car, and we drove during rush hour all the way down to this like middle of nowhere place, and we pulled into the parking lot. The parking lot's empty. There's a stray dog like roaming through it, like tumbleweeds blowing. I mean, I was like, why don't we just go? Like, let's just call it. This is most certainly not our guy. But we went in, and inside was this like 6'4 jacked like dad who's so excited about women's skincare, like you just would not believe.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on today's show, how Emily Weiss turned her fashion and beauty blog into Glossier, a brand that's now shaking up the entire cosmetics industry. So back in 2012, Facebook paid about $1 billion for Instagram. And you might remember we actually interviewed the Instagram founders back when we first launched the show. Anyway, what made Instagram a valuable proposition to Facebook at the time wasn't profitability. Instagram was basically a free app where people posted their photos. But what it did have was 20 million users. And Facebook saw in Instagram what it saw in itself years before. You build the customer base first, and then you figure out how to monetize the business with those customers. Now, this isn't an easy way to start a business. You have to create something for free that's compelling enough to keep people coming after you introduce the product. And this is sort of the story of Glossier. And I say sort of because when Emily Weiss started her fashion and beauty blog back in 2010, she didn't do it with the intention of one day creating her own cosmetics brand. But what happened was that blog, Into the Gloss, it blew up. Hundreds of thousands of readers became obsessed with hearing about other women's skincare routines. And so as the blog grew, Emily started to wonder, could I actually create a cosmetics brand for my readers? So in 2014, she found a single investor, and she launched a small line of skincare and makeup products. And today, just 4 years later, Glossier is valued at around $400 million. And her customer base of millennial women is the envy of the cosmetics world. So now, how did she do it? How did Emily Weiss seem to come out of nowhere to disrupt an entire industry? Well, the first thing to know is she didn't come out of nowhere. Emily's been walking the walk since age 15, when she talked her way into an internship at Ralph Lauren and then got a college job at Vogue, where she ended up working for several years before quitting to focus on her blog full time. It's a blog that inspires fierce passion among her readers. And when I sat down with Emily for a live interview on stage at the Skirball Center for the Performing Arts in New York, you could hear that passion in the crowd. I think you've got a lot of fans
that
here, Emily.
That was amazing. I wish I could do that every day.
You just like walk into your living room,
yeah,
and there's like a big cheering section.
Yeah, I go home from work, you know, and just...
All right, so can we This is actually a very serious question. Can we clear one thing up? Is it Glossier or Glossier? Glossier. Okay. Do people sometimes ask you that question?
All the time. Yeah. Even in France. We just launched in France, and all the girls were like, "It's Glossier," and we were like, "No, at least
it's
here.
Glossier.
You guys should know."
Yeah. Let's start when you were a kid, right? You grew up in Fairfield County, Connecticut. It's not too hour and a half from New York City. Tell me what you were like as a little girl.
I mean, I was really weird. I mean, I'm still really weird. I'm into a wide variety of things. So, love animals. I had almost every kind of pet. Hmm. I mean, I had like an iguana, like a turtle, a pair of blue cap cordon bleu finches.
Yeah.
Like I bred guppies, fancy tail guppies, and
wow.
tried to sell them to the
a
fish
guppy
store.
A guppy breeder and a makeup, you know, right.
Yeah.
Who knew?
At the same time, I was super into, I think fundamentally storytelling. Like I was really interested always, and I always have been, in the power of narrative and storytelling and kind of imagining like complete worlds or like systems.
Yeah.
I was definitely, you know, very into makeup. I used to make my own costumes. Like I would like sew like butterfly costumes for Halloween. And
yeah. Was it just something that you naturally gravitated towards? Just
for sure.
Yeah.
It's not even like fashion specifically or beauty specifically. It's again that like power of creation. Like you can create yourself through fashion and beauty, and you can create different looks, and you can kind of use them as tools. So I've always been really interested in kind of, you know, beauty products are like crayons, you know, or clothes are kind of
like
crayons.
It was an outlet for your creativity.
Exactly.
So if we were to hop into a time machine and go back to high school, your high school era, and we saw you there, would people have identified you at the time as like, oh, there's Emily Weiss, she's really into fashion, like, and you would see this high school student sort of dressed, you know, differently.
Yes, but it wasn't good. Like I wasn't good at it. I was probably doing things way too young. Like I remember, well, I'll tell you one thing I did. I went to my first day of middle school in a new school and new town. And God bless my mom, because Clueless had just come out. And I was really excited about wearing those outfits. And so I wore thigh-high stockings to my first day of sixth grade with high-heeled loafers and like a full kilt and like a feather pen in this like town where people were playing lacrosse and like, you know, like sport. And they were like, who is this girl?
Like many teenagers, you were a babysitter.
Mm-hmm.
And you happened to do a babysitting gig for a family that would eventually land you an internship at Ralph Lauren. How did that happen? What's the story?
I mean, that is, you know, people often ask me what amount of your success is attributed to luck. Mm. I really believe in kind of grit. And I mean, I didn't make that up. That's Angela Duckworth and her book, Grit. A very good book, but that actually just was luck. I mean, that there was nothing gritty about babysitting for your neighbor's kid, and he happened to work at Ralph Lauren.
The dad worked at Ralph Lauren, but you were like 15, and how did the conversation come up? You were just like, "Oh my God, I love Ralph."
It was a very brief conversation. I remember standing in their kitchen, and at some point, I don't know how long I'd been, you know, how many times I'd babysat for them, and at some point, he said, "I work at Ralph Lauren in New York City," and I said, "How can I work at Ralph Lauren in New York City instead of babysitting your kids?" And they were lovely. They were really great. And he was a real sport to propose, you know, to Ralph Lauren HR. This is a long time ago. I'm sure this is illegal now, given I was 15. But I went in and I interviewed with HR and I went through the process, and I think they saw something there, and I worked my butt off for 2 summers.
And you were going to Ralph Lauren's
headquarters on 650 Madison Avenue. It was on Madison and 60th. There was a hot dog stand in front that I would eat, like, by. I was so excited about. I'll never forget this. I was so excited about getting these hot dogs. I mean, I was in New York City. Like, I was like, this is what you do. They were like, oh my God, what are you eating? Like, do not eat that. I remember, like, I didn't know.
And what do you remember about, Like, what did you do there? I mean, you were a 15, 16 year old.
I did whatever they had. Photo, you know, I was so happy. You could give me anything. I was scanning, I was running errands. I was the happiest intern you've ever seen.
Did you ever meet Ralph?
Oh, yes.
You did?
Yes.
Really?
So I remember I was in a room, you know, I was the note taker. So I was sitting in the room in the back and in the corner, and like, you know, everyone was, I don't know, meeting, and I was taking notes. And Ralph turned to me, you know, I think I'd actually maybe shaken his hand and met him at one point, but he doesn't know me. And, you know, and he goes, and everyone just stops, and he looks at me and he goes, "What do you think?" I don't remember what I said. I don't remember. I just remember like the whole thing stopping and him asking because they were talking about something. I don't even know. Yeah.
Wow. So you did those two summers as an intern at Ralph Lauren, and then it was time for you to go to college. You went here to NYU as you studied. What did you study? Studio art. And once you moved here, you got another internship at Vogue.
Yes, at Teen Vogue.
At Teen Vogue.
Yeah.
And by the way, I know, a lot of us have an impression of what it might be like to work in, you know, like a Condé Nast fashion magazine from Devil Wears Prada.
It's a great film.
It's a great film.
It's a great film.
Is there any truth to that?
I mean, so I was really fortunate because I had a great boss. So I was actually at, you know, Teen Vogue as an intern, and then at Vogue, which was the job that I had before building this company.
Sure.
It's kind of like anywhere. It all depends who your boss is. Like, yeah. Doesn't matter what company you're at. It's like, isn't there that thing? I just heard from someone that your personality is a result of the like 3 or 5 people who you spend the most time with. You know, if you work with great, smart, talented people, which I was very fortunate to do, then you learn a lot.
When you were an intern at Teen Vogue and then you got your first job out of college at Vogue, did you envision that your career would be as a fashion writer or a fashion editor? Is that what you thought? This is what I'm going to do with my life.
Yes. I mean, my dream was to be an editor-in-chief. So at the time, you know, in my early 20s, that was, you know, I looked at someone like Anna Wintour, and that was incredibly inspiring to me.
So how did you, I guess at some point you were able to write for Vogue, you were able to write an article, which was about, I think it's about self-tanning.
So, yes.
Right?
Yeah. So this is kind of funny. So I'd interned in, I was always working in fashion, and beauty is kind of like this ugly stepsister to fashion in magazines and in media. It's really funny because all of the ad revenue, or most, a lot of it, comes from beauty in these magazines. But if you think about it, like, if you're reading an issue of a fashion magazine, beauty can sometimes, at least, you know, 10 years ago, be like 5 or 6 pages or 10 pages. You know, there's such little airtime dedicated to, you know, this topic that in many ways you're like forced to deal with on a more fundamental level every day than even what you're wearing, right? It's like personal hygiene. So I'd never covered this. Like, I enjoyed beauty and I love talking about beauty with people, but I'm not even someone who's wearing, you know, who's like obsessed with beauty in a way, if you define obsessed as being, you know, wearing a ton of makeup or spending like lots of time, I don't know, getting facials. Like, that was not me. But I was on a shoot in Miami, Florida.
This is like 2010?
This was 2010-ish. And I was on a shoot in Miami, Florida with Doutzen Kroos. I don't know if I'm saying your name right. Is the model. And we were in a trailer, which is often the case. You're in this, like, you know, RV. And at some point, the model Doutzen, she started talking about this, like, amazing self-tanner that she loved. And I don't even think I'd ever used a self-tanner. And she was like, all the other ones are, like, crazy. But when you use this one, you exfoliate this way. And then you put it on, it's, like, air foam. And it doesn't smell. And, you know, all these things. I was like, I gotta go get this friggin' self-tanner. It's gonna change my life. So I remembered it and I got it from the CVS in Wilton, where I was for the summer. And it was great. I mean, it was really a great experience, this self-tanner. So I wanted to write about it. Like, I was like, someone else needs to know. Like, I heard it because Doutzen told me, which is a super crazy situation that no one else is going to be in.
Yeah.
And I need, like, my civic duty is to, like, share this with the world. So I went to the beauty editor of Vogue, who was the full-time beauty editor, and I hadn't met her. And, you know, she's this legend, Sarah Brown. And And I was like, excuse me, you know, I have an article. I'd like to, if I can write for Vogue.com, I think I would love to just submit it to you. And if you like it, you can publish it. And if you don't, like, whatever. I just have to, like, tell someone.
Yeah.
And she said yes. And I wrote this article. It was, like, little article about the self-tanner. And she published it. And so that was where I actually caught the bug, where I was like, I remember I had so much fun writing this post. I'm sure you can find it and Google it. It's like, I don't even know. It might be terrible, but it was such a cathartic moment to have this conversation around a product that I never really felt around, like, a shirt. Like, it was like, I mean, I wanted to, like, wear a cool shirt and look nice in a picture, but I didn't feel the urge to be like, is anyone else out there wearing this shirt? Like, can we talk about how great it is? It just, it didn't get that bug.
And it was just a few weeks or months later when you actually decided to launch your blog, which would become famous, Into the Gloss.
Yeah.
Is that why you did it? It's
for
connected
sure.
to that article?
Yeah.
You wrote that article and you thought, okay, I need to figure this out and do more of this.
Yes. I mean, you know, this was the era of personal style blogs. It was like when all the, like, bloggers were starting, and it was kind of this new thing, not democratizing, but, like, really individual, being like, these are the human beings and how they actually put these things together, right? As opposed to sort of very tightly held images from fashion brands or campaigns. It was like, this is what's actually going on, literally on the street with fashion. And I remember thinking, well, why doesn't this exist for beauty? Like, why is there no, like, in-depth exploration of people's beauty identities and, like, beauty stories? And there's really nowhere to find. I mean, certainly there's blogs that have existed long before Into the Gloss around beauty, but it was typically much more about kind of, like, what's new. Like, it would be like, this new mascara from, you know, XYZ brand just hit the market and it's so great because of all of these things. Yet I often thought, like, it's not necessarily what's new that I'm most interested in, it's what's best. And this idea of what's best in beauty, I think, is fascinating because there's no single what's best.
Yeah.
Like, I might love a, you know, matte lipstick and say it's 5 out of 5 stars, but you might love a shiny lipstick and be like, this lipstick's dry AF. I don't want it.
Guilty.
It's 0 out of 5.
So how did you actually launch this blog? I mean, was it sort of as simple as, like, going to WordPress or whatever blog, you know, hosting site and setting it up?
So I'm not very technical. So WordPress is what hosted the first blog, and I had a really amazing set of collaborators who
I found.
How
much money did you have to put in to
literally
start?
I mean, I'm going to contradict myself, because I'm sure in another interview I've said, like, 900 or 700 or, like, 850, but
under
$1,000
to launch Into the Gloss.
Yeah, because the website part was not expensive.
Right.
The money literally was just for the camera.
To buy a camera, because you knew you were going to take photos.
Yeah. I spent a Canon DSLR. It was a great little camera.
But what was the vision of it at the time? And I'm sure it evolved, but when you went to, like, your parents or your friends, you said, I want to start this blog that's going to do what?
That's going to give a voice through beauty, give people a voice through beauty.
And what was the first post about?
First post was a publicist who worked at a fashion PR firm called Nikki Deem, and I thought she had, like, really cool hair and great sort of, like, style, and she was Australian and kind of, and I just interviewed her and I took a picture
just
on the street.
Just asked her about, like, her whole routine.
Her whole routine, yeah. Beauty approach to hair, beauty, makeup, the whole thing. And it was a very, very short. They'd progressively gotten much longer. And it was a picture of her, and that was it. And we were off to the races.
Now, here's the thing. You are, at that point, Emily Weiss, a young woman in the world. You don't have a giant network of people. You don't have a whole lot of money and access to media platforms. How did people even know about it?
Yeah, so, I mean, listen, I definitely was in a great position to attract, you know, people to be featured on the blog. Now, whether or not they said, yes, I want to take an hour out of my day to go be featured on an unknown website with an unknown reporter was a different question. But I was sitting on, you know, the floor of photo shoots with, like, a 15-year-old Karlie Kloss, like, tying her shoes. Now
wow.
She's, like, you know, a supermodel who's got 9 million Instagram followers.
So you would say to her, hey, would you mind talking
to
me?
Yeah, I mean, we're all kind of spending so much time together. It'd be like, hey, can I take your picture for my new blog? And I had enough goodwill and a lot of people said no. I mean, literally 80% of the people I would ask. But I think once I started featuring, if you have a couple people, then different media sites would start to, hyperlink and say, oh, today there's a profile on, Carly Kloss on this blog called Into the Gloss. And so that's how it took off.
And you would basically feature a different person and their regimen and the products they liked. And that was it. That was, because that's a pretty clear
model. Yeah, it was very clear. And I think, I've always focused a lot on good design. Like, my personal philosophy is just don't put things out into the world. Don't make work that isn't really great.
Yeah.
It should be time well spent, don't waste people's time with bad content. So the fascinating thing about Into the Gloss is some of our most popular features, they're not celebrities, we're in this celebrity culture and we hear how much, influence influencers have. And yet, if we all really take a moment to think about who's the last person who told us where to eat or you liked their outfit and you saw, it's they're probably not the biggest celebrity. It's probably someone who, a friend from college that you follow on Instagram or, someone you work with. And I think that democratization of expertise and around, not just expertise, the democratization of influence, just the power of the individual to influence another individual, is something that's fascinating and part of the reason I think why Into the Gloss really resonated.
You were doing this, just to put this in context, you had a full-time job at Vogue. This was your side hustle. You were doing this on nights and weekends?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. Into the Gloss, transcribing or posting or editing. And then on the weekends, I would do all the shoots and the interviews. Mm-hmm. So I'd book the interviews and the shoots. And each one, I had your job. I love interviewing people. Yep. So I would sit on people's floors in their bathrooms on their closed toilet seat lids, with my tape recorder out.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because it's so hard for women to be the right level of maintenance. If you're too low maintenance, then you're lazy. There's this stigma of the person who isn't doing enough. And yet if you're wearing a lot of makeup or you're look like you really care about, beauty or appearance, then you're seen as sort of frivolous or not to be taken seriously. So the kind of intricacies of beauty as a anthropological tool is really, really, really fascinating to me.
Yeah. I'm wondering, at what point after you launched Into the Gloss did you start to realize that it was more than just, some friends or a couple dozen people or a couple thousand people, but tens of thousands of people? Was that pretty soon after it launched?
No, it was a slow build, but within the first year, it was such that, I had gone to my first brand and I had my first media partner with Lancôme.
That was advertising?
It was cash money.
And it was Lancôme.
Yes, it was Lancôme.
And was it enough money to sustain it?
No, it was $5,000. And, this was more money than I'd ever had in my life, ever had in my bank account.
I mean, I think it was 2.5 years before, after you launched Into the Gloss, you were still with Vogue for
1 year.
1 year.
12 months, because at that point, we had enough. It's funny because people always say, well, how did you, this is one of the key questions for entrepreneurs, right? When do you quit your day job?
Yeah, how did you know when to quit Vogue to go full-time on the side hustle?
Super personal decision based on a ton of different, very personal factors for any entrepreneur. For me, it was really just one decision to make, which was, I have to pick one. This is taking too much time and there's too much momentum. It's impossible to continue to deliver the product that people want. Readers wanted, and at this point a really big community was really wanting, that I felt like there was really no choice. It's not even just follow your gut. It's follow something that is really working, is really delivering, changing things.
And once you knew that, you knew it was time to throw everything into that.
Yeah, it was time.
I mean, I would have thought that at that point, you know, into the gloss was you were sort of thinking about this as a media property, right? Like this is a blog, maybe you would spin it out into a podcast or a video show or something else, or like a deal with cable TV. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happened. You decided to create a product. Was that, I mean, again, like, was that something that just kind of happened on its own, or was it a really deliberative,
yep,
thought through thing?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And I think the thing that has led to every decision that I've made is this very central thesis that you can create conversations and connections through beauty. And Into the Gloss was the first version of that. Like, that was the first step. It was the necessary beginning that showed a certain behavioral shift. You know, it was like, encourage people to be like, oh, okay, I'm sharing now what goes on in my bathroom, you know, that I used to do totally alone. And in doing, you know, in working on Into the Gloss for the first year, I was exposed to all of these beauty companies. Hmm. So I was working with Lancome, I was working with Estee Lauder, I was working with Coty, I was working with, you know, every big conglomerate. And beauty is a huge industry. I mean, it's a $450 billion global market.
Wow.
It's going to be $750 billion in 6 years.
Wow.
And why is that? Because of social media. Because of sharing, because of the ability to have conversation, that beauty is now something that is not just tightly held in the hands of salespeople at, you know, a counter. You know, when was the last time any of you have, like, really relied on that?
Yeah.
50% of people who go into a Sephora take out their iPhones. You're Googling, you're texting your friend, I'm in Sephora, should I get, what was that thing you told me about?
Right.
You know, that's how things work. And what's interesting is these companies, I was hearing in these interviews from women as I was sitting on the, you know, on the bathroom floor, I was hearing this, like, disconnect that would have been answered if beauty brands just listened. Like, if the actual beauty brands were listening to, well, first of all, if they knew who you were, which they don't because their client is the retailer. Beauty brands,
right,
build products and clients for the needs of, you know, Macy's and, you know, Sephora and Ulta and CVS, and those are shelf space needs and seasonality needs and margin needs and all of these different needs that have nothing to do with you as the customer. So that results in this kind of subpar, like, product experience and kind of brand relationship. There's not really this, like, personal, like, you get me relationship. Mm-hmm. And that was what led to the creation of Glossier, because all of every beauty brand that I've ever known has been built tops down. And the idea for Glossier is, what would happen if you could build a beauty brand bottoms up? You could ask a question like, who makes your dream face wash, and get 1,000 responses? Who would play your face wash in a movie and have them say, Eddie Redmayne? It's like, what the f-?
Yeah.
You know? So, so that was where the idea from Glossier came from, was, you know, this is the next phase. Like, this is the next way that we can bring together this mission of giving voice through beauty.
I mean, didn't anybody say to you, do you really think you can take on, you know, L'Oreal and Estee Lauder and Revlon? I don't even know the names of the biggest. I mean, these are huge, enormous multinationals. Like, did anybody say, you know, this probably is not going to work?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, literally all the odds are against you, like, or against, you know, maybe not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them. I mean, for one, you know, 4% of venture capital deals last year went to female CEOs. So 4 out of 100 deals went to women. So already it's like, well, how am I going to fund this thing? Because, like, you know, no one's going to give me money for this.
You needed money, obviously, to create a product line.
For sure, yeah.
And did you have a number in your head of what you needed to start?
In fact, I do. And it was based on precisely nothing. I was like, it is going to take $1 million.
That's what you said.
Yes.
$1 million.
I bet you I need $1 million to make this happen.
When we come back in just a moment, how Emily got her $1 million, found a chemist in the middle of nowhere, and a new tribe of customers just about everywhere. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. Support for this podcast comes from American Express. Tracy Schechtman is Vice President of Global Experiential Marketing, and her team created Amex Business Lounges at chaotic trade shows. Here's Tracy on how the lounges have adapted to fit customers' needs.
When we first came up with the idea for business lounges, we filled the lounge with laptops and with printers. And what we found was that people weren't really turning on the laptops and they weren't using our printers. They were sitting down and they wanted a place to call their kids. And that really helped us evolve what we were doing. We needed a lot of soft seating and we needed some quiet areas that can absorb sound. We were able to recognize these people as more than just business owners. When customers are using our lounges, we hope that they walk away understanding what it means to be an American Express customer. It means that everything that we do accounts for the human behind the job, not just the job that you're there to do.
To learn more about how American Express can have your back in life and business, visit americanexpress.com/dobusiness. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This from NPR. So it's 2013, and Emily Weiss has decided to make her own beauty products, and she thinks she'll need about $1 million to make it happen.
How did you know where to start? I mean, you're in the New York fashion world. Obviously, you've got the successful blog, but like a lot of that is Silicon Valley. It's yep. like VC money's out there, and yep. that's a whole world. Mm-hmm. How did you know where to start?
Well, first of all, I was like, what is VC money? Like, what is VC? Like, what is, I'm like, oh, venture capital, what is that? I mean, let's not forget, I went to art school. Like, I did not go to business school. I did not work at a tech company.
Yeah.
And by the way, a lot of founders of, you know, fast growth venture-backed companies worked at a fast growth venture-backed company, right?
Right.
So as an outsider, really hard to sort of understand
this. And intimidating, probably.
Very intimidating. But again, back to that power of grit. I just kind of plowed through on this, you know, exploration. Like, I think my personal superpower, if there's like one thing that I think is I'm really good at, I'm super curious. Mm. And so I kind of made a list, frankly. It wasn't even just about raising money. I remember having a whiteboard.
Yeah.
Like, what are all the steps it's going to take to build this company? And I wrote, you know, VC, like raise money, build website, find chemist, you know, make logo, you know, shoot.
You just like wrote this on a whiteboard.
Yeah, I still have the picture. Yeah. Like, what are all the ingredients that this is going to take? And of course, you don't know until you find out from one conversation what the other ingredient is you're missing. And you just have to start. You have to start somewhere. So, you know, the money needing to get raised happened pretty early in that process.
What was your like elevator pitch to VCs? So you go in and they'd say, okay, next.
Yeah. My pitch to VCs in the beginning was, you know, we have this great community. We understand, you know, beauty and people and stories, and we have this robust community who we believe deserve a better brand, like a brand that really hears them and understands them. And there's a lot of room in the market because this is a huge, huge industry, really ripe for disruption. There weren't very many direct-to-consumer brands at the time. Now you have, you know, ColourPop and Kylie and Kim Kardashian and all these different, you know, D2C kind of brands. But that hadn't happened.
Yeah. I read that you pitched, I don't know, 13 or 14 VC companies, and mostly men, and only one eventually agreed to give you that initial funding. It was the VC was a woman, Kristen Green.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Yeah. So 6% of venture capitalists are women. And hopefully that will go up. So listen, we have incredible partners. I think, you know, initially, so much of funding is around pattern recognition. And so you have venture capitalists whose job it is to make smart bets on companies that are going to grow super, super fast and become the next Facebook, right? And so it's hard to, I think, look at like a female CEO who does not have a business school degree and sort of say, we're going to take the bet. And it felt, you know, it's exhausting. And I think I know a lot of entrepreneurs, and I think it's hard for everyone. It was exhausting to go, and we would hand our COO and I, we would hand our products, you know, we'd have our little goodie bags and bring them to different rooms full of guys and have them get the bag and say, oh, that's so nice, thank you, I'm going to give it to my wife and, you know, ask her what she thinks. And I would say to myself, if, you know, some like financial technology company came to me and pitched me, I wouldn't be like, oh, I'm going to go ask my husband to like explain this to me.
Yeah,
I would like learn about it. I would like be like, show me your product. Let me understand this. Let me put it on the back of my hand. Like, can you tell me about like how people use this product? And the best people did do that. And we have, you know, a handful of really amazing venture capitalists. We have a 50% female board, and our first investor, Kirsten, I spent a lot of time with, and she was that $1 million check.
She believed in this idea. She wrote you that check.
Yep.
Do you know why she decided to take the risk?
She has a really gut and data-backed knack for identifying consumer product companies. Mm-hmm. She invested in Warby Parker. She invested in Bonobos. She invested most recently in Away.
So she's got good instincts.
She has really good instincts around, around what are people going to care about? What do they want to live with? You know, like what do they, what moves people? I mean, this is a really emotional category, beauty. Mm. You know, again, there's no like single truth, right? So it's really just about like opinion and preference and so many other ingredients.
All right, so you've got this $1 million, right?
We raised two.
Oh, wow.
Because you can't spend everything that you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how do you start a makeup company? Like, where do you go? Like, who do you call up and what do you say? Like, oh, can you make me this makeup? Well, there's chemistry involved. Like, how do you...
Indeed.
How do you make makeup?
I mean, you know, let me tell you how I built this. So my first hire... So first of all, always hire for your weaknesses, right? And surround yourself with just the most brilliant people you can ever convince to come work on the shared vision that you have. And my first hire was an incredible director of product development who had over a decade of experience at MAC Cosmetics. That was my first hire because I've never made a makeup product and I don't know how it works or vendors or how long things take. Like, I have no idea. And I remember she ended up getting a recommendation for a chemist from someone who she knew from the beauty industry who was based outside of LA. So we flew to LA, we got our like Hertz rental car, and we drove during rush hour all the way down to this like middle of nowhere place. And we pulled into the parking lot. The parking lot's empty. There's like a stray dog like roaming through it, like tumbleweeds blowing. I mean, you know, it was very, it did not look like this was going to be our chemist. And there's this little mirrored building. It was literally like mirrored so that you couldn't see inside. I mean, I was like, why don't we just go? This is most certainly not our guy. But we went in and I am so glad we did because inside was this like 6'4 jacked like dad who like has who's like building game-changing skincare products for some of like the biggest brands that you guys are literally sitting here wearing products that he's created.
Wow.
Who's so excited about women's skincare like you just would not believe.
Wow.
And that he became our chemist and he's actually developed like I don't know almost all of our skincare products.
And what do you say to him? You say, I want, you know, this scent, or I want it, like, how do you tell him what you want?
Yeah, it's really a huge collaboration. I'm trying to think of, like, what I can equate it to. Maybe, like, the relationship between you and, like, your architect. Like, if you're, you know, building a house.
Right.
It depends, because there's lots of, like, each of us would have a different relationship with an architect. Like, one of us might go to them knowing exactly what we want with exactly the ingredients and the exact approach to sustainability and exact budget and, like, might be super involved. And other ones of us might be like, I kind of want, like, a white house, you know? And so, like, where we were is we were more in the former camp. And so we came and said, we have these four products. We want them to do these things. We want them to, you know, have these ingredients and not have these ingredients. And we want the price to be this. And so we have to figure out, like, how to find the most amazing, you know, ingredients. And it's really just a back and forth. And we would spend, you know, on average, maybe like 2 or 3 months or 4 months of just shipping samples back and forth to each other. But a lot of it was just nerding out in the lab.
Yeah.
He had like a little room full of ingredients, like raw materials is what they're called. So literally, like, there'll be like a vat of like Koopa cow butter from like, you know, the Amazonian rainforest just sitting there. Like, that's like part, one of the things you see listed on the back of your, you know, whatever, will just be in bulk sitting in a thing. So he would say, like, undo a jar and be like, smell this, you know, or scoop out a thing and put it on your hand and say, it's like being in a chef's kitchen. And so it really is all about that personal relationship that you have and your ability to work with someone, your ability to like riff off each other, that has led to some of the most amazing innovations.
It seems like baked into the business model from the beginning was this very deliberate idea that you were not going to have your product in the CVS or Sephora or at Bloomingdale's or Lord & Taylor, wherever, that this was going to be direct to consumer. Why wouldn't you make it available at these other places?
Because we can build better product by having a direct relationship to every person.
How?
We don't have to make decisions for anyone other than the end user. Like, full stop. So first of all, that alleviates a ton of things that don't matter to you holding something and enjoying it and using it. It also enables us to like ask you questions. It enables us to like send you like questionnaires, you know, have you been happy with this? Do you like what you got? You know, how would you improve it? What should we make later? It allows us to create platforms that connect our customers with each other to talk about, you know, shared experiences around beauty. So, you know, we've put 1,000 of our top customers in a Slack channel who exchange over 10,000 messages a week.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I was talking to several people about Glossier, and you know, it's many women will go into a Sephora and try stuff on, and with the question is, how do you know what this is going to look like? And what's amazing is that you can just go on YouTube and type in, you know, Glossier, this...
Boybrow.
Right, exactly. And you will find dozens and dozens of videos from women with different skin tones and shades, and you can almost see what it looks like.
Absolutely.
It's almost like you know, most companies start with a brand and then build a customer base. You had a customer base, and then you introduced your brand to them.
Yeah, although, you know, our customer base now is much wider than, you know, readers of Into the Gloss.
Yeah.
For sure, but I think what you just described is, again, this kind of, like, shift of influence. And it's not about, again, the influencer being this 2 million follower, 3 million follower thing. It's the ability for your feedback on Boybrow, like, that can be our customer's video, right? Like, that's, it's like, this is how I use this, and this is how it works for me. And if you go into our stores, we have two flagships, one in New York and one in LA. That is what is happening in there. I mean, women are waiting in line down the block, meeting the person in front of them, the person behind them, talking about whether or not they'd used Glossier before, like what they like, what they don't like, where they're from, do they need a roommate? Like, suddenly they like work together. Like, you know, these are like lifelong relationships that are being formed. And then you go upstairs and people are up there for like an hour and a half, and they're talking to each other in the mirror saying, what color is that? And they're barely even talking to the people who work, you know, work here.
But what about for women who don't have access to those stores? I mean, makeup is such a personal thing. I mean, most of your customers are buying the products without trying them on first. So how did you know that people were going to be willing to take that leap of faith?
Well, I think part of it is by having a product philosophy and an approach to content that facilitates that leap of faith.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if we had, you know, a super high coverage foundation product, then that would require us to make, you know, 50 shades or something, or 55 shades or something like that, which would be almost like impossible to sell online. I would have a really hard time like shade matching myself if there were 50 shades of something. Like, I would not know how to do that. But what we can do is create, you know, a product like Boybrow that's super intuitive, that's super easy to use, that doesn't deposit too much, that, you know, is sheer enough that it can span a wide range of eyebrow hair colors, you know, something that facilitates that participation.
You launched this company in 2014, 4 years on. First of all, how many employees do you now have?
Oh, we have, so it changes every week because we have like five people starting, like even this Monday. Now we're, I think, 186 full-time wow. employees and 150 showroom editors.
I think since that first million or 2 million in seed funding, you've raised more than 80 million.
Mm-hmm.
The company is now valued at more than 300 million, maybe close to $400 million. 4 years. That's crazy. I have to imagine that the big cosmetics companies, the L'Oreals, the Estee Lauders, are really paying attention to what you're doing and really want to buy this company. They really want to own this brand. I mean, you know, you can go down the list, Bobbi Brown and you know, some of these other iconic brands that were purchased by the larger brands. What happens if and when they approach you? Maybe they already have.
So the companies that I most admire are companies that create iconic products that really stand the test of time. The other thing that I think a lot about is our mission. So I think about how else can we connect people through beauty? How else can we help people sit up a little taller, feel better about themselves through beauty? We have a really long way to go in terms of actualizing that vision. In fact, I think about where we are today as truly just the beginning. Like being 4 years in for me, I wake up every day, I think it's day one. And typically when you sell to a larger conglomerate, it's because you need more distribution. Because the benefit of having, you know, being a L'Oreal or an Estee Lauder company or something like that is that they have this vast network of retailers.
Yeah, store around the
world. Macy's and all those things.
And you don't need that.
We don't need that. We create, you know, our own channel through our digital platform, through Glossier.com. And one of the things that we're most fascinated by right now is the fact that this beauty shopping experience, this experience of walking into a store and yet wanting to be connected to someone who you pick and wanting to find information through a person that you relate to or that you are inspired by or choose, there's really nowhere to do that online. Like you can go on YouTube, but it's really like looks based. It's really about kind of like, I want to do a cat eye or I want to do a unicorn Halloween makeup or something like that. But in terms of finding that individual story for beauty, it's really, really tough. So we actually just hired the person who built DMs and camera at Instagram. And then we also made another hire of the guy who was employee 9 at Instagram, who's an amazing product designer, digital product designer, because we're spending a lot of time thinking about how to create that digital platform, that channel, because we've already built these tools, right? But like, where is the place where people can come together to talk about beauty, to share what they've learned from Glossier and all of the other brands and products that, you know, they use and talk about, and how can they find each other? Like they do at our flagships.
I have to imagine that the big cosmetics companies are looking at your customer base, very young, multiracial. It's a super coveted demographic that you've got. Hard to recreate, right? Because there's an authenticity to what you do and there's a risk of inauthenticity when you try to manufacture it. Are you watching your competitors as well? Do you keep an eye on what they're doing?
Well, it's interesting because beauty is not that competitive in my mind because how many different brands are we all using every day? Like how many different lip products do I have in my purse right now? You don't want to know. From like all different brands, like 8 different lip balms and lip glosses and lipsticks. And I'm not interested in like consolidating that. Like that is like not a realistic expectation of any of us. Like no single brand can make can meet, you know, all of your needs when it comes to beauty, at least in my mind. So for us, it's just about how can we be a part of this conversation? How can we be a part and how can we most importantly facilitate the conversation happening?
Yeah. When you think about, and you partially answered this earlier, but when you think about the arc of your career and you're still so young and you have so much to do ahead of you, you may build 2 or 3 more companies, who knows? How much of what's happened to you and what you've accomplished do you attribute to your persistence, hard work, grit, and how much to lucky breaks?
I think I definitely believe in luck, but I don't rely on luck, and I don't attribute luck to where I am today. I really believe that it is a combination of this passion and this perseverance, and probably a little bit of having a very short memory. I think it's such a gift. I just keep going. I think when you fall, or when someone says no, or when something, you try something and it doesn't work, the ability to just continue, like just pick up, there's a resiliency, right? Like that's really when I hear the word grit, that's what it says to me, is there's a resiliency to just brush, shake it off, right? And keep going.
Yeah. Just one last question for you. If you were sitting in this audience 10 years ago and you were watching somebody like you and you had a dream or an idea in your head, what would you have wanted to know? What do you now know that you wish you knew when you were starting out?
I don't know. I would use the Phil Knight quote from Nike of like, just do it. You know? I mean, it's as cheesy as it sounds. Be courageous. Like, be curious and be courageous. Because the worst, it's like my friend says about dates, it's either a good date or a good story. And yeah. I think that's really good advice. Like, try things. It's going to help you grow and learn, you know, learn something about yourself. I really do believe that.
Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier.
Thank you.
I spoke with Emily on November 1st at the Skirball Center for the Performing Arts at NYU in New York City. And just a few days after that, Glossier opened its first permanent flagship store in New York at the very same address where the company was founded. The new space is painted in Glossier pink and is ready for the camera, which means if you couldn't be there, you may have seen it on your Instagram feed. Our episode was produced this week by Rachel Faulkner, with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Neva Grant, Jeff Rogers, J.C. Howard, and Sanaz Meshkinpour. Our intern is Mia Venkat. And look out for another live interview coming your way this Thursday. On Thursday, November 29th, check out our next bonus episode from the How I Built This Summit in San Francisco. It's my conversation with John Zimmer, founder of Lyft. Oh, and one more quick thing. If you want to actually attend a live taping of How I Built This, we just released a few more tickets to our sold-out LA show on December 5th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. I'll be talking with Michael Dubin, founder of Dollar Shave Club, and you can grab those few remaining tickets by visiting nprpresents.org.